We're joined by our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Hard Rock and Rich Kimball?
Well, it is not a great day here today, but I'm thinking a guy like you, a true Zulu warrior, is out there walking, running, hitting the stairs, and not really concerned about this kind of thing.
Well, you would be correct, as you usually are, my friend. I just came back from the aquarium. Actually, about an hour ago, I was looking at penguins, and I ran my 5,000 stairs today. I'm sorry that the Maine weather is cutting into your tanning routines. Oh, I got your DM about the nude beach, by the way, this summer. You realize that I don't have a car, even if I was amenable to going.
All right, well, then you'll just have to imagine.
I mean, you really should qualify that. So you'll just have to continue imagining.
Yeah, there we go. Well, we thought this week we would talk about some more stories from your wonderful book. The most recent one is If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. And, you know, what's remarkable about this book, we talk about it as a short story collection. It is and it isn't. It also, in many ways, reads like a novel because there is a connection. And even though the stories may be about wildly disparate people, there's a connection in relationships and communication and in the humanity of these characters.
A lot of life comes down to that linguistic equation you just laid out. It is and it isn't, because these characters are so different from each other, and also the stories as characters, just how I like to think of the stories in this book, that each story, it's like there's Bob, there's Sally, but they happen to have these titles. They're so stylistically different from each other, and yet they belong together. The book engenders a kind of community. And so works that I have liked, been very passionate about in music, for instance, like a White Album. A White Album, none of the songs in a way go together stylistically, and yet that album works across the four sides, this being an old school double album, in this humanistic way that it adds up in this sort of paradoxical manner that it wouldn't seem quite possible. But when we covered like the four stories before, I remember we were going from like an avant-garde grocery story list story to a young adult sports story for adults. And you go through the entire book and it never repeats. And yet it builds in these sequences, which is something that I know we've talked about one of these particular stories before that deals with sequences, but we'll touch on it in this actual context of the book too.
Let's start with Eep and Abe, which features two fairly familiar characters in a very different setting. Eep and Abe is Edgar Allan Poe and Abraham Lincoln taking a walk along the water in a netherworld that is a very interesting place in many ways. One, because they also like to keep up with the lingo that the young people use today. And so the language is sort of a cross between what they likely would have spoken in the 1800s and today.
Yes, they haven't completely ironed it out, their vernacular, because there are these snatches of like wanting to be hip with how the world speaks now and the language of their time. So to set this up for readers, these contemporaries in life are now deceased. They're in the afterlife. And in real life, Poe and Lincoln never met. But Lincoln was an admirer of Poe's work. And they both suffered from depression. Really, it was sort of like one of the defining themes of both of their lives. And at the time, this would have just been called melancholy, melancholia. It goes back to somebody like Robert Burden, writing about the anatomy of melancholy in this giant book from 1621. And so in the afterlife, they're buddies. And when I come at you with a story, anything I write, I never just come at you with one thing, because life doesn't work that way. So if you're reading something by almost anyone else writing right now, a work of fiction, you know from the first two or three sentences everything that it's going to be. You know the emotion or lack thereof that is going to feature throughout. you know, okay, they're trying to be funny, so the entire thing they're going to be trying to be funny, or they're going to be over-dramatic and serious, and that's the way it's going to go right until the end. This is a humorous story. It's a touching story. It's a ribald story because they have this giant sex device that they sort of loan out to each other because they're trying to kill the boredom. And I think a lot of people are there where they're just looking for ways to thrash the tedium from their lives. And it's almost like you see it all the time with like porn addiction and things like that. But they're also so unhappy that they're still trying to do away with themselves, which is something that occurred to both men back in their actual lives. But they're unable to achieve another death. So they're forced to rely upon really their friendship and what hope. Again, that's why it's in the subtitle of the book, what hope that they can glean from their interactions and the way those interactions help them process the world around them in this afterlife.
But in this afterlife, it sounds like Edgar Allan Poe has met some of the same kind of individuals you have in the world of online dating.
Poe is up against it because he's trying, but like, you're Poe. And so it's difficult when you are Poe. I always like joke to people that sometimes when I personally, in my own life, am looking at these dating sites, it's like Beethoven on date. Like you picture like Beethoven going out and he sits down for the coffee or it doesn't even get that far. Someone writes him something like, I'm a composer too. Beethoven, he's just done. He's glowering and he's had enough. Like this cartoon figure, you picture him like shaking wildly, like he's some drill bit. And Poe is not really meeting people, not that he's looking for people on his level, but he's looking for people so he doesn't have to go down too far. He has like a baseline. So then when that's not working out, his Poe-like mind, fittingly enough, gets him up to all kinds of no good. And it turns out that Lincoln, Ghost Lincoln, is a bit of a voyeur. Like, he's like, tell me more.
Right.
It's one of the, like, there's no way I could say it here. But one of the funniest things I've ever written is this sort of, like, hypothetical situation that Poe is going through. And he's doing this dialogue that he has with this ghost woman. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. The whole, like...
Yes, I do.
interior thing. When I was reading the book back, I thought two things when I got to that. It was, like, going through the revisions. I thought, what the hell is wrong with you, Fleming? How could you write something like this? And then I just couldn't stop laughing. It was like someone else wrote it, and I was Ghost Fleming getting to read it for the first time. But it's also really a sobering story. So you get the humor, and you get the tragedy, you get the friendship, and you get the community, because we even get community between two people.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown Stories from his book, If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. The next story, Analogues, a wickedly atmospheric story that puts you in this hospital room with a man on duty being there for his mother-in-law, even though the people closest to her are not there.
Right. So he is there in the waiting room. I'm sure a lot of listeners can identify with being in the waiting room, even if they wouldn't have this man's exact circumstances. It's like when you make a movie, there's a lot of sitting around. Or frankly, if you make Sergeant Pepper and you're Ringo Starr, you're sitting around. A lot of times when someone is dying, you're sitting around and it takes time. Someone I knew once said to me too, that we have to help people to die. And as scary as that sounds, it's not like a euthanasia thing, but there is a truth to that. If you've been in the hospital setting, the doctor will sort of ask you questions. Do you want to do this? Do you want to prolong the treatment? And this man has been pressed into a kind of grim service where his own wife, whose parent is dying, is not at this hospital. She is off with his father-in-law, which sounds sketchy in a way. And he is this person doing this tour of death duty. And he's describing this scene, which plays out in what is the ICU waiting room. And he talks about, because you sort of like affix names to the people you see. And he talks about, it's one of my favorite characters, the woman from Wednesday.
Oh, it's a remarkable character. And the game the clock game that he comes up with. It's just beautiful.
So, you know, those like those clocks where the digital clocks and they have the in each number, they're comprised of little bars. So like a number one, for instance, has two little bars and eight has the most bars. And I think like 1208 out of all the time has the most bars. He counts them all up and he's playing this game and he imagines that the woman from Wednesday is really old. And so she's probably there for someone like a spouse who's dying and her time is not going to be far behind that spouse. We can suppose all these things, and she has this hacking cough, and she eats out of the vending machine, and the guy is getting angrier and angrier, saying that I've read all of these magazines dog-eared, and he uses that dog-eared term as a verb, and we find out why his wife is not there, why she can't be present for even the death of a parent, and we get this information, and it's just like, wow. And then we get this reaction to the man's internal monologue, what he says about children. And I remember when I wrote that, someone said to me, you can't do that. You can't say that phrase. And it's funny that I look back on this because here's something that I thought, a little tidbit I had for you today. I thought this would really surprise you. This was written over 20 years ago, and it reads like something I could have written earlier this week.
I would never have guessed that.
I reached this point in my writing where I realized that I had hit the top level and I would get better, but getting better meant that I got there faster. I could do more at the same time. But I knew when I wrote a certain story like this, and this was like the second or third one, it's probably the second one, that I knew it's like, okay. And then it was hard for me to get to that level and to get there as quickly. But it just is not a long story, word count-wise, but it contains volumes, has all of these different things and all of these different areas and temporalities happening in it. And I think the ending of it, too, because, again, we have community between this man and the woman from Wednesday. There is this connection that might even just be imagined on his part. And it ends on this kind of, like, rhythmic progression of beats and then boom, close, scene.
What's the significance of the title of the next story, Sequentials?
Because I think that this is the one we've talked about before, and I think it works well in the book and with the themes of the book, because we often think of life and our own lives as a record of a continuity. And we think of like landmass A, bridge, landmass B, and there's a connection. But I think one of the reasons that collage art is so powerful is because life is a series of sequences. It's not bridge related, that you're going to have landmass A, Gulf, landmass B, and then where we get our meaning and what our lives come down to is the relationship between A and B, which got there first, what the one says about the other, what they each bring out of each other and their contrast and their similarities. And so I wanted to write a story, and it's a way that I've written just, of course, so many stories, but I've organized a number of them. There's different ways to organize everything. Story dictates it, it tells that to you. There's a collage way to organize where the juxtaposition is the de facto bridge. And that also gets the reader involved, too, because the reader is now going to parse out the relationships. Why am I seeing these three things? And also, subconsciously, as you're seeing those three things, your mind is filling in that bridge for you, because that's really how we find meaning. It's never a continuity. So you have these three bits, these three pieces, and one of them is, the first one is like this horror story of this guy who is, we get the sense that he's at this bad time in his life. He's between things. So he himself is that gap between the land masses, and he's doing some yard work to earn whatever money he's getting at the time. And there's this sawhorse and this window well in which he sees this sort of hellish diorama, and he ends up encountering this woman who seems like she might be a ghost, but we're not sure. But it's terrifying because within the actual sequence, there are these jump cuts where she approaches him that's how she ambulates towards him. And so when we have like a jump cut in a Godard film, it's usually from scene to scene. But here you have the jump cut within the sequence. So you have the idea of like that hopping around that we get in the story, that we get in life, within this actual piece of narrative.
In the second section of the story, The Remainders of Long Division, I underlined this line. It blew me away. If I did not know better, if I did not know that no matter how much something looks like something, it can always be something else.
Yes, I think that's, again, one of the themes of the book. The job of the artist is to position us in a way that we see what is there better vantage point. Like, here's your seat, the front, the stage, proper lighting, nice angle, that we wouldn't see on our own. It's all about positioning so we can glimpse what is there to be revealed. It's not making what is to be revealed so much as putting us in the position to see. And that's why the best writers are working with readers. It's a partnership. We are on the same team. We just maybe have different labels attached to us, but we're here for the same thing. And this is a story about a relationship breaking down. And in one regard, it seems like there wouldn't be anything to it, but it becomes highly charged and dramatic, and it comments on itself and what's happening. And then the book really is a whole, but without acutely commenting on it. So you kind of like, it's a nod and a wink, but it's not officially one. It's the type of thing that you're walking around later when you think about the story that occurs to you on some level of your brain that doesn't even have to be your conscious level, because we exist in all these different spheres. So it's a wise story, and it also has that sort of aphoristic element. But again, it's not like, okay, here comes the quote that you're going to want to take away. It's just going to be the quote that you end up taking away.
And then in the third section, Into the Present, our narrator is watching the great Robert Mitchum film Out of the Past. There's a woman in the audience that is certainly interesting and appealing in many ways. And then a guy, a lunkhead guy, maybe not a Chad, but one of those type of guys. And the reaction to him went down a road that I absolutely didn't expect.
Or maybe because of the nature of the picture. Like, let's think about this. Again, we'll do the work of readers. Who goes to a screening in our age? Because you can tell from the language that this is not like 1951.
Right.
It's not the late 40s when the film came out. Who goes to a screening of Out of the Past? It's like sort of an art house showing these days. It's not at the multiplex, and it's like an intellectual sort of person or a film buff. So you're probably dealing with someone who is mentally ill. And what they're doing, and it's also an interesting question to raise, is this the same protagonist in all of these different stories that are part of a larger story? Not necessarily, but also maybe. And so this person is like ripping up cups and making noise and being this distraction. And the protagonist the entire time is like looking at this woman. And we get the sense that he's between things, romances or heartbreaks, as it were. And he's sort of fantasizing about this woman in the sense that, well, she's here. I love this film. There's like four people at this movie house. She could be single, we could hit it off, blah, blah, blah. And he's also annoyed with the guy who's up front, a few rows down from him, trashing his cup and making noise. But he realizes at the same time that he's probably mentally ill and he doesn't even know what he's doing. He can't help himself. Film is over, lights come on, and the woman walks down to the guy, not the narrator, not the protagonist, but the guy who's torn apart his cup or whatever. And she says something to him that we do not see coming and that the protagonist didn't expect and doesn't really want to hear. And he's going to go his own way after that. I think it comes as quite a jarring. There are sort of these wallops, like we talked about one of them in Analogues, when the guy sort of gives you the details on like why his wife can't be there. And this is another wallop at the end of this short story that has these short stories within it, these sequentials.
Well, there are a lot of wallops in a very short story that comes next, An Incident in Cathedral Romance. It is so many things. It's an adventure. It seems to be an allegory. It's a lesson. It's absolutely fascinating. I finished it and immediately went back and read it again because it was so rich with detail.
I think the observations are, spot on. And is what I'm going for with these things too. It's, I guess we could say the setting is somewhere in the Middle East in a way, but it's going to be a story within stories. We're going to find out at the end. And this ritual is being enacted between these different tribes, something of that nature. And it's like, it feels like it's long ago, like it's in the time of Aladdin and flying carpets and stuff like that. And this, there's this citadel type of structure, and this beasts are being lifted over the walls, and this ritual is going to be enacted that is like kind of war centric. Like the theme is war, but it's not like outright battle. It's like they take turns, like, okay, you can come here and be like, you kicked our ass, and then later it's our turn and everything. But it becomes this ultimately, this execution. And the protagonist of this story is involved with this young person like himself that he hopes has a character or an understanding that he's going to learn that she doesn't, when there's this scene of someone bleeding out and she doesn't intervene to do anything about it. And I think it speaks to things are often out of our control, and we hear that cliche, control what you can control. But I think that's also a way for us to kind of beg out, because we do have often control, and it's just that it's difficult for us to wrest that control and to take the actions necessary to implement stages that are going to bring meaning to our lives, keep relationships together, or make them work in a way that they've been bogged down in the past so that they can sort of transcend that. And we get this, all of this, it's like a living diorama, this allegory. And then we cut at the end to, we're in a class perhaps not unlike your own, and it's a teacher giving like a lesson, and the students are reading something, and they're all weighing in with their different theories about what has happened here, what the story means. And like this one kid kind of gets it and has this sort of knowing moment with the teacher, like at the very end.
And it also illustrates the folly of war in only a few pages, but this idea of people being faceless and nameless and the roles changing, but the result is always the same. And there's that moment where it's explained that if the ground is not smooth, the blood won't be absorbed. When the ground is rough and patchy, it pools there. And who wishes to see that?
Oh, I think we're seeing with what's happening in the Ukraine, sort of a prescient story that way for our age. War is highly theatrical. And I'm not even talking about misinformation. But like, you know how when you're watching MASH, like they're off on the sidelines, like they're Bill Belichick and the staff on the sides. Like you drive to the war, then you come back. Like it's like, okay, don't drop artillery over here. Like, you go to, like, a kind of battlefield, like, what time's battle? Like, let's do this. And I think that's more pronounced now, when it's like, okay, let's knock off the hostilities for a while and funnel these people out down, like, whatever street, this, the avenue of this. It's sort of stage-managed. So this is thematically, symbolically underscoring that, because this is very ritualistic, this actual war, because you think it's like, oh, they're like cosplaying, and it's like when you go to the farm and the guys are playing like barehanded baseball from like 1842 type of thing. But then someone is like disemboweled. So it is, it's real. This is happening. There is the blood steaming from the earth. But I think it sort of talks to that sort of mechanization of that play acting that's lethal of war and the folly. Because there's a certain amount of, even though it's very stately, there's a certain amount of like buffoonery happening here, where it's like people are, they're just like eating, and it's like, oh, you want some of this, have a sausage type of thing. And so, again, I think it's timely, but it also speaks to that a certain interiority, that war that we're all sort of waging to some degree at some point within ourselves.
And I love the teacher and his thoughts on the lesson here. He felt that it helped to cope with life. Not that too many of them had too much to cope with yet, but still one could learn early.
Right. And so I think it's important, too, that the wisest person in the story, at least so far as we can tell, isn't just a young person and a young person who's learning about the nature of what you can and can't control. It's a person with a young mind. And I was talking to someone a little bit older the other day, and life is really like, it's like rope climbing. And I was saying to them, like, you always have to be conscious of your grip, like that your hands are tight on the rope. We can call that different things. I tend to call it mental discipline. It's just a certain sharpness. It's like whenever I have to, like, erase a word in something I've written, you know what I do? I end up just, like, erasing the entire sentence because I want to be able to write the sentence back exactly the way it was. It's just a way that I keep my mind sharp as I'm writing all of these different things. And when you're not conscious of your grip on the rope, you start to slide. And when you start to slide on a rope, you've ever like done this in gym class, I don't know if it still happens, you slide fast. It's not just the hands are burned, your ass is on the bottom rather quickly. So I think we see this young mind is sort of like learning that, and the teacher of the class knows it. And this could be sort of like a reference to this bad thing that's happened in his life. And the student who gets it is a sort of like living embodiment of that character who's a character in a story within a story.
The book is If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. It is available everywhere. Make sure you get your hands on it. Is your streaming session, your Zoom session tonight on Sam Cooke?
Oh, it is. Yeah. And the only thing is, like, I don't even know what I'm going to read. Like, you'd think I'd be prepared. All I'm worried about is the Zoom. I have never, the Sea Dog has never Zoomed before. Now, a guy like you, you're probably an old pro at Zooming, but I'm just worried about how that's going to go, and hopefully nothing freezes. And they're telling me that I have to wear clothes. And like, that's obviously like a downer because you know me. Once we're done talking, it's like Triscuits and like shirtlessness.
You know, it depends on how you aim that camera, like so much else in life.
Oh, I hope it doesn't pick up how I live or my desk. The desk, I'm looking at the desk today, I'm thinking like, all right, well, maybe just scoop everything up in your arms and put it to the side. I'm like, well, I'll trip on it later. I'll break my neck. I will just be like, I'm all Dickensian. And it's like, this is the real stuff. I'm giving you like the cinema verite. I'm an artist. Man. Oh, I can't even say man. I can't gender people. It's like 100 people. I hope it goes all right.
That's 8 o'clock tonight, right?
Yeah, Eastern time. And Kimball, if you're there, I don't know if I'd be able to see it, but if you're able to make it, feel free to ask a question. You'll probably be like hardrockandrichkimball@AOL.com at the bottom or something like that. I'll be like, hey, I know that guy.
The link is on your website, right?
You'd think I would have taken care of that. If you go to my Twitter, you can find it without much duress.
Okay.
If you scroll through like a few things, it's like Arlington Memorial Library in Illinois, and you just have to register for the webinar on Zoom, and then I guess you get a link or something like that. And it's me talking about Sam Cooke and question and answers, and I'm going to read something or other, and definitely not expose myself at all, save emotionally, intellectually, mentally, and spiritually.
Well, that's tonight at 8 o'clock. Colin Fleming, thank you as always, my friend. We'll visit with you again next week.
Okay, thanks, sir.